Hey folks, it's Jesse, the founder of MaxFun. Since we postponed our annual MaxFun drive in mid-March, we have gotten a lot of questions about if and when we'd be rescheduling it. And honestly, we've been asking ourselves the same thing. Well, now we have an answer for you. The 2020 MaxFun drive will start on July 13th. That's coming up soon. We decided to have the drive now because it's always brought a lot of joy and excitement to our community and certainly to us. And to be totally honest, it's also the main source of income for some of our hosts. Like pretty much everything right now, this year's drive is going to be a little different. We'll still be bringing you very special episodes, fun community activities, premium thank you gifts, but we also know it's a weird time and for some folks, a really difficult one. Some people are in a position to become new or upgrading members, others can't right now, and that is okay. We'll have ways for you to support MaxFun at every level, including some ways that won't cost you anything. We're also going to run the drive for 4 weeks instead of two. We didn't think it was a good time to be rushing anybody, and having a longer drive lets us be a little more low-key in our drive pitch. It also gives us more time to do fun stuff, like the weekly live streams we'll be putting on for charity throughout the drive. Most importantly, we want the 2020 MaxFun drive to highlight all the ways we support each other and our communities. We also want to show how grateful we are to you for making all the work that we do possible. Stay safe. We'll see you July 13th for the MaxFun Drive.
Hello, this is Rachel McElroy.
Hello, this is Griffin McElroy.
And this is wonderful.
Do you think the audience would be okay with just 45 minutes of dead air silence? Me and you climb under the desk, lay down, take a quick 45 minute snooze. I'll turn on the meditation app. I'll turn on some white noise. We're in the studio so I can crank the, you know, the sound system with some...
And that Soulja Boy.
I can crank the Soulja Boy because I know that you love listening to that to help you sleep. And the two of us will just treat ourselves to a little schnooze. Because our listeners are always talking about, hey, what could, hey, you guys are always just pouring your heart out of your sleeves into our open ears and mouths. And what have we done for you lately? And it's like, that's a good question. Maybe we could just do a dead silence 45 minutes of episode and you don't tell on us to advertisers or MaxFun. Do you think they would, our audience is a decent size. Do you think they would all be cool? Because all it would take is one weak link to send an email to Jesse and be like, hey, get them in trouble.
If you took that 45 minute snooze.
Yeah.
Do you think it would really make a difference?
It would make more, is better than nothing, huh?
I guess that's true.
I think it'd be great. And I think let's try it starting right now. Can't sleep right now anyway. I'm too excited to talk about how excited I am to talk about how excited I am on this week's episode of Wonderful. It's a show where we talk about things that are good. And how are you doing?
Pretty good. Pretty good. A little stressed.
That's a lie. I feel like neither. We just had a remote teaching sesh with our son's daycare, which has reopened in a limited capacity. We have not sent Henry back in.
I think, you know what helps is I keep reminding myself that they are doing this because they think we want it.
Yeah.
They're not doing this to set us up to fail. They're thinking, let's offer them something.
Oh, it felt like it though, huh?
30 minutes on the floor with his classmates. Learning about the planets.
Of Henry playing like a reverse staring contest to see how long he could go without looking at the people talking to him on the computer screen. It was rough stuff.
I keep reminding myself, they think we want this.
Right.
They're not doing this because they think we need it.
Right.
They think we want it.
Yeah, they're so wrong. hey, do you have any small wonders, though?
You always ask me first, and I'm never prepared to go first.
Right.
So I think
ultimately,
you should just, declarative,
I'm
have
going
a small
first.
Wonder.
Grenadine, I enjoy it in a cocktail. It's a cherry syrup. Long before I was, before I drank adult beverages, we go to Applebee's, and I would say, let me just get some Coke with some grenadine in it. Because they didn't have cherry Coke most of the time. I'd just be like, let me get a Coke with some grenadine in it. And that was always such an exotic treat for me, was Coke with grenadine. I've always fostered a love for this sweet red syrup. and I enjoy it in many a beverage for grown folks these days. And that's my story, folks, and I'm sticking to it.
I will follow your theme,
okay,
and suggest taking a fruit juice and putting it in a cocktail.
Okay.
We have been really good lately about getting a lot of fruit items. We've had some watermelon, some pineapple.
Maybe not to brag, watermelon, pineapple. You heard of them? We got them.
And so a lot of times I will take the juice from that fruit. I will put it in my cocktail.
Right.
It is a summer treat.
You haven't lived until you've seen Rachel pick up a whole watermelon with her hands.
And just squeeze it.
Yeah. And the juice comes out without the sort of hull of the husk of the watermelon breaking. I don't know how the fuck she does it.
Yep.
It's pretty incredible.
Looks like a deflated balloon.
It's like she's wringing out a towel. Mm-hmm. It's incredible. Hey, you go first this week. What you got on deck?
I am bringing something, and I'll be curious to hear your experience with this, because I don't know if this was just a phenomenon for me.
Okay.
I'm talking about collage.
Collage of many things put together into one thing.
Things cut and glued on a piece of paper in a pleasing array.
Are we talking about sort of the like artistic, like Eric Carle? Is that the dude's name? The Hungry Caterpillar fella? I did a whole fucking segment on him. I can't remember his name.
That is.
He like worked in collage. You're talking about that, or are you talking about like here are some pictures of my favorite members of 98 Degrees?
Why just one and not the other?
Okay,
both.
Okay, maybe it also could be like an artistic spread of pictures of Nick Lachey's face and body, abs, nipples, powerful arms.
Just isolating particular body parts and pasting them separately.
I can see your dad like going into your room and be like, "Hey, Rachel," and just seeing you putting together a huge poster board of just Nick Lachey's nipples,
mm-hmm,
and where they have sort of found their way to the surface.
Oh, this is terrible.
This
is grotesque, Griffin.
Like a highway map of Nick Lachey nipples.
No.
Okay.
Just to be clear, I was not a fan of the 98 Degrees.
Baby, you don't have to impress anybody here. We're all friends here.
Collage was a big thing for me in maybe middle school.
Mm.
This was something that you would give to other people a lot of times on a birthday.
Whoa.
You would take photos and cut them up into little shapes and put them on a piece of paper. I was suggesting that you might have experience with this because I thought maybe after one of your theatrical performances, there were collages made of people in character.
Mostly as like director's gifts. Mm. And in fact, that was fairly traditional. More like scrapbook or poster style design, not like, you know, I feel like when you say collage, like you have to be cutting interesting shapes. Just include a bunch of pictures all glued together. The only time I remember me doing this is I made one for myself of all my friends.
Yeah, right.
That I had in my room. I bought like a big poster board at like Walmart or something like that. And I was very excited about it. And I just like thumbtacked all these pictures of...
One of my friends, this was several years ago now, was cleaning out his stuff from his parents' house and found his collage from high school, posted it on Facebook, tagged us all. It was a trip.
I remember destroying my collage and just taking all the pictures down off of it. I think when I moved to Cincinnati, because I had to do a real hard, I was really trying to condense my life Marie Kondo style long before that was a thing. And saying like, well, I could fit all of the photos on this in one very small sandwich size Ziploc bag, or I could carry this entire huge fucking poster board with me across state lines. Didn't make the trip.
I will say in middle school, one of my friends gifted me a blank journal, but on the inside cover was a collage of Leonardo DiCaprio photos.
And was this, I imagine the journal didn't come like this.
No.
The journal.
No, this was,
okay. So what was the thinking there? Just like, here's a place for you to safely write some of your most erotic poetry about Leonardo DiCaprio.
My argument is that she took an impersonal gift of a journal, made it personal by cutting up pictures of a celebrity that I liked and pasted them.
What's the message though? Because a journal is like where you do some creative writing or maybe a little bit introspective writing. And is it like, here's a journal, and I'm going to go ahead and give you a prompt. Look at all these Leo nips. It's Leo nips all over the front cover. You look at those, you center yourself for 15 seconds, and then you begin writing.
You have a strange misunderstanding of what a teen girl finds attractive about her love interest. It is not typically nipples.
I think your memory is starting.
Yeah, no, you've got your finger on the pulse of...
My finger right on it.
Collage is something that is also used in high art form, not just, you know, teens. We became most familiar with it, I think, as a globe with the Cubist painters, Pablo Picasso, Georges Braque. They kind of would take a painting and then maybe cut out some newsprint in a shape or something and put it on the painting. It's also called mixed media a lot of times.
I'll call it freaking lazy. Just paint. Just paint it. Use paint to paint it.
Who is this character, by the way?
I don't know. I'm so tired. I don't know who it is. I don't know who's coming out of me anymore.
But this was not actually something that they originated. This is something that has been around forever. Japanese artists began to stick paper onto silk as early as the 1100s.
Whoa.
In Europe, paper collage happened in the 1400s. The technique of just kind of taking prints and putting them on canvas is something that is very common. In the Victorian era, this happened a lot in scrapbooks and homemade Valentine's cards.
Adorable.
Yeah.
And I mean, stained glass windows is also, if you think about it, just glass collage. If you really sit down and you think
like
about
it. Like a mosaic, I guess, would be another example of tile collage.
Tile collage. Uh-huh. Everything. And really, if you really think about it, paint on canvas is just a paint collage.
Oh.
And if you think about it, a sandwich is just a meat, lettuce, and cheese and bread collage. If you really think about it, I am a blood, muscle, and bone collage. Think about that.
Wow, you are writing a poem over there, and I am loving it.
The universe is just an atomic collage. Whoa, that's something. Hey, babe, there's something to that. Write that down. Write that down in your Leo nipple journal. Atomic collage. Ooh, that's good. Collage. Ooh, that's
powerful. That is good. There was actually something similar. Feminist artists in the 1960s, there was an example of a piece called Body Collage, where the artist rolled around in shredded printer paper.
Yeah.
Her body painted in wallpaper paste.
Cool.
In what she called an active collage.
That's neat. It also reminds me, I don't know, oh man, I can't go down this whole rabbit hole. There is a series of G.I. Joe... like PSA spoofs that were like early internet videos.
Oh, is this body massage?
Just sounded like body massage.
Yeah, that's nothing.
It's nothing. It's nothing. It's absolutely nothing.
This is also something pop artists use, just taking everyday ordinary objects in their work.
Yes.
And then also, if you think about the 70s and 80s, posters for bands like the Sex Pistols used a lot of this collage. So I think it's interesting to just kind of look at, you know, this is like an at-home, a decoupage. You take a table, you put a bunch of pictures on it, suddenly it's art.
Love it.
Or, you know, you can go into a gallery and see a lot of this too.
Yeah.
I think it. I find it really accessible because a lot of times as an artist, my skills of capturing an image are not great.
Don't sell yourself short.
But babe, if I can cut it out of a magazine, paste it on something, all of a sudden I don't have to draw, you know, that globe. I've got a picture of a globe.
I'm really obsessed with globes this segment. Just a lot of globe chat. Can I tell you about my first thing?
Yes.
My first thing is weird and abstract and sort of conceptual, which is just sort of where my mind is at right now. Opening a treasure chest. It's always so good to open up a treasure chest.
This must be why unboxing videos are so popular.
I think it is. There's a lot of sort of ways that you can extrapolate this idea out into the real world. I think, yes, unboxing videos. I think the surprise egg, surprise bag sort of YouTube craze for kids where they, you know, make fairly cheap toys and you open up a bag and, oh man, there's a 1 in 48 chance of getting this, you know, silver Gudetama or whatever the fuck, It's a very universal thing, and especially in sort of the domain of video games, opening a treasure chest is like such a common thing. And it struck me that, like, regardless of the game or whatever thing, regardless of like whether or not I even know what's inside said chest, every time I open up a chest in some game or whatever, there is a dopamine kick associated with that that is just sort of like irrefutable, 100% of the time, no matter what. And I think that's kind of like I don't know, the icon of opening a treasure chest, the symbol of opening a treasure chest being that sort of like consistently exciting.
Yeah.
It's kind of incredible. And it's like, that's ubiquitous across like all games. Zelda is like a huge example of that, where you're exploring dungeons and there's little chests with, you know, cash or keys or bombs or whatever the fuck in it. But every dungeon has one big chest that you're working your way towards. And every single time you're opening up that big chest, like, oh shit, here it goes. D&D, obviously, any role-playing game, it's like a big thing. I've been playing a card game on my phone called Slay the Spire, which is all around like 1 to 2 hour long runs, along the way you'll open like a dozen chests. And even though I've played it for so long, every chest I'm like, fuck yeah, what's gonna be in this one? I don't know. Also, I think that there is a, we mentioned the surprise bag toy craze. In video games, there's also a concept called loot boxes, which became sort of legislated over the past few years, because it's like, you know, this game is free, but here's a random box you can buy for a dollar that might have a new costume for your guy in it. And kids were spending hundreds and thousands of dollars on these loot boxes because they were not sort of financially responsible or financially sort of educated. And game developers were sort of like enticing them to blow huge
stacks
of cash.
Also, yeah, you have no understanding of money.
Yeah, that's the thing. And so, like, legislators have sort of come after that practice and made it more sort of, you have to be more transparent about, like, what's in these boxes and what your chances are of getting each thing. And, you know, if you're a YouTuber, you can't juice the system because a developer, like, paid you money to give you a fake box that, oh, man, this one has all kinds of great stuff in it. I don't know why I talked like that just now, but basically it's gambling. Anyway, treasure chests as like a concept, as an icon, are a trope largely because of pirates and the like concept of buried treasure, which, you know, is the origins of this idea of keeping treasure in a box in clandestine locations. And archaeologically speaking, there are lots of examples of troves that have been discovered, or hoards that have been discovered, and like so much so that there are like all kinds of categorization systems for that archaeologists use when describing what are they called, wealth deposits, which is really interesting. I'd never really looked into it. There's a concept called a founder's hoard, which is comprised of like unfinished objects that the like creator was planning on returning to.
This makes me think of the pyramids.
The pyramids also largely included what were called votive hoards. And votive hoards were essentially hoards of treasure that were never intended to be dug up. Like, that is their final, yeah. they are buried there to intended to be their final resting place. So for a lot of ceremonial purposes, the pyramids had a lot of votive hoards. The idea of buried treasure is almost entirely like fictional, and there are certainly some examples like throughout history of just sort of like mad rulers burying their vast sums and then like it instantly being found because somebody didn't keep a secret or whatever the fuck. But the idea of a pirate doing this is almost unheard of. The only pirate sort of confirmed to do this was William Kidd, who was sailing in New York City. He started out, I think, a privateer, but he had for sure slipped into doing a great deal of piracy. And so he buried treasure, I think, in Long Island somewhere before sailing into New York City to use as a kind of bargaining chip in case he was caught and prosecuted. He could say, like, well, don't hang me because there's all this treasure. That gambit did not work. He was killed. And this became sort of the origins of a lot of fictional stories like the Gold Bug by Edgar Allan Poe, and most notably Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. And that is how this like idea of a treasure chest being this object of desire hidden away in some dungeon or whatever rose to prominence. I think that that is just a cool idea. Like, I think it's a cool thing that there is a... games are all about building around, like, feedback loops of, you know, challenge followed by reward, where your efforts are sort of put through the paces, and then you receive a prize for said effort at the end of it. And almost ubiquitously, that prize is a treasure chest. And, you know, even though it's been in every game forever, it's every time I open a treasure chest, I'm like, fuck yeah, here we go. What's in this box? Let's find out.
I bet, like, archaeologists and paleontologists, like, I bet that's part of the reason they got in the game, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
This idea of just, like, stumbling upon something incredibly valuable, you know, that you have to, like, work to, you know,
and I'm sure
identify.
There's an archaeologist that, like, cracked open a crypt somewhere, and there was just a bunch of gold and treasure laying on the ground, and like, ah, fuck. If only this had been in a chest, that would have been so much cooler.
It's so messy.
I could also get into, like, the concept of mimics, which is another sort of fiction, obviously game thing of monsters in the shape of treasure chests, which is like a manifestation.
Oh, I didn't know about this.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a tropey sort of D&D thing.
You know
that's
what
also
I'm picturing right now?
What's
I'm
that?
Picturing a treasure chest with arms and legs. Is
yeah,
that
yeah, and
that's
a
right?
Big tongue and sharp teeth. Yeah, more or less. Yeah, essentially. Wow. But that would if I talked about that, I would sound like a big nerd, as opposed to a cool athlete like I have
like
so far
normally,
today.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, can I steal your bike?
Yes. Griffin, we have personal messages.
Yeah, baby.
This one is for Nick. It is from Shannon. You are the most wonderful person I've ever met, and after 1 year together, I still can't believe you exist. Thank you for coming into my life and loving our tiny, furry idiots as much as I do. You make every day feel like a Friday pizza party, and I can't wait to hang out for the rest of our lives. Bread babes forever. See you later. Lick.
I don't know why Friday pizza party hit me as hard as it did.
Me too.
Because I heard that and I was like, what does that mean? But then I thought of like what a Thursday pizza party looked like. And I was like, fuck that.
See, I was thinking like it was more like the class had earned it and they were rewarded.
Oh my God. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Like you got enough stickers or something and now you got a pizza
party. We got
party.
Enough stickers. We're going to get some $5 hot and readies and we're going to watch the first 45 minutes of Finding Nemo. Here's another Jumbotron. This one's for John, and it's from Emma, who says, hey, love, I'm writing this on your couch, soon to be our couch, because I'm finally moving to Austin. I couldn't ask for a more supportive, caring partner, and I can't wait to start our life together. Here's to many years of endless pop culture references, homemade pasta, and finally getting me to watch The Wire. Love you, always, of course.
I would recommend Austin as a destination.
Yes, maybe not in the middle of them dog days.
That's when you moved here, right?
I did. I moved here in July.
Yeah.
So the days didn't get much doggier than those. Mm-hmm. I think I showed up here and immediately my underwear was just like completely saturated with sweat. Like I stepped off the plane and it was just like, shoo.
Hey, I'm Mallory O'Mara, a weird fiction reader who enjoys whiskey and owns a book weight.
And I'm Bria Grant, a science fiction reader who likes iced tea and reads to escape the world.
And we host Reading Glasses, a weekly show that dives into reading suggestions, goals, complaints, and the really important questions like, what are the best reading snacks?
And seriously, Mallory, what is a book weight for?
Every week, we talk about reading.
It's not a book club. You're not going to have to listen to us review a book you haven't read.
You just have to be excited about books, authors, the bookish community, writing, and talking about reading.
We can literally talk about reading, like, all day long.
Reading Glasses.
Every Thursday on MaximumFun.org. Glasses.
I thought about doing that.
Hey, what's your, what's that second thing?
My second thing
is...
Mm. A trip to the Poetry Corner.
Hey, oh my gosh, I feel like it's been so long. The Poetry Corner, toss salad and poetry. We got some lines, we got some verses, and baby, come along with me. But I don't know what to do about those salads and scrambled poems. They're calling again. Do you like how I shorten poems into sort of one?
I do, actually.
Like, poems. How do you say it?
Poem.
Yeah. Poem. It's stronger.
I would like to talk about an incredible poet who I knew first as a poet, but is actually known for many things, and that is Audre Lorde.
Oh, okay.
If anybody that has taken a woman's studies course, has studied feminism in any way, has heard of this incredible woman.
I've heard of this incredible woman.
Yeah. I was wondering if I was kind of off in thinking of her as a poet first, but she has created 11 volumes of poetry.
Whoa.
And 5 works of prose.
That seems like a lot.
It's a lot.
That's 16 things altogether.
Audre Lorde was a Black American writer, feminist, womanist, librarian, and civil rights activist. She described herself as, quote, a Black lesbian mother warrior poet.
Fuck yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Fuck yes.
So she passed away in 1992, but was kind of at the beginning of the whole concept of intersectional feminism.
Okay.
Because as she described herself, you know, a lot of her qualities crossed over and
sure.
impacted her feminism. And she was always kind of critical of non-intersectional feminism. And this is kind of one of those famous things that you may have heard before. This is a quote from one of her essays. She said, "Those of us who stand outside the circle of this society's definition of acceptable women, those of us who have been forged in the crucibles of difference, those of us who are poor, who are lesbians, who are Black, who are older, know that survival is not an academic skill. It is learning how to take our differences and make them strengths. For the master's tools will never dismantle the master's house. They may allow us temporarily to beat him at his own game, but they will never enable us to bring about genuine change. And this fact is only threatening to those women who still define the master's house as their only source of support."
I've heard, yeah.
Yes, right?
Okay, yes.
Yes. Yeah. she became an academic relatively early. She started as a poet, got her like poems published in 17 magazine, and then got a fellowship that allowed her to teach, which is actually where she met her partner of many years, and became kind of a member of this academic area that was primarily white, and kind of had to discover a lot about herself and her priorities and her interests in that experience. So she was a poet, but then also became an academic and ended up writing a lot of essays about her experience. And I wanted to read one of her poems.
Please do.
So this is from the collected poems of Audre Lorde. It was copyrighted in 1978. It is called A Litany for Survival. "For those of us who live at the shoreline, standing upon the constant edges of decision, crucial and alone, for those of us who cannot indulge the passing dreams of choice, who love in doorways coming and going, in the hours between dawns, looking inward and outward, at once before and after, seeking a now that can breed futures like bread in our children's mouths, so their dreams will not reflect the death of ours. For those of us who were imprinted with fear, like a faint line in the center of our foreheads, learning to be afraid with our mother's milk, for by this weapon, this illusion of some safety to be found, the heavy-footed hope to silence us, for all of us, this instant and this triumph, we were never meant to survive. And when the sun rises, we are afraid it might not remain. And when the sun sets, we are afraid it may not rise in the morning. When our stomachs are full, we are afraid of indigestion. When our stomachs are empty, we are afraid we may never eat again. When we are loved, we are afraid love will vanish. When we are alone, we are afraid love will never return. And when we speak, we are afraid our words will not be heard nor welcome. But when we are silent, we are still afraid. So it is better to speak, remembering we were never meant to survive."
Jesus
Christ. Isn't that incredible? That is such a beautiful expression of the experience of being marginalized, right? Like,
I mean, in a way that you and I could never fully comprehend for sure. That is like, I'm like struggling for words over here.
There are moments in that poem that I just think are so succinct and brilliant. This idea of so their dreams will not reflect the death of ours, I find incredibly powerful. And she talks a lot about this idea of, you know, when you are in a group of marginalized people, you are often told to be silent, to kind of adapt to the culture so that you can get along. And Audre Lorde oftentimes said, like, that is not a way to success for
us.
You know, that is not who we are. That is not going to bring us the freedom we want. The Audre Lorde Project was founded in 1994, 2 years after her death. It is a lesbian, gay, bisexual, two-spirit, trans, and gender nonconforming people of color center for community organizing. And it is all building on her legacy of speaking out for oppressed and marginalized groups. She left such a legacy in her writing and in her activism that, like, the work still continues today in her name, which is an incredibly powerful thing for a poet.
It's so, that was so fucking incredible, baby. Mm-hmm. Thank you for bringing that. I for sure had, like, heard her name before, but I had never, like, heard her poetry before.
And she's an intimidating person to bring because it's difficult to talk about her impact in a, you know, 10-minute segment.
No, yeah, of course.
But I wanted to draw attention to her poetry because I think a lot of people do know her for her activism and her essays and her critical thought. But her poetry is incredible, too.
Yeah.
This is an important person to look into if you are not familiar with her work. And there is a lot there that just reads as revolutionary, but then is also so common sense.
Yeah.
You know, there's something kind of intimidating about a lot of philosophers and intellectuals and academics. And I feel like she stays very rooted in who she is and the power she can bring in just being that person.
Yeah.
And so I would recommend it.
I'm not talking about fucking Fritos or whatever. No, my second thing is, I'm actually pretty excited about it. I was struck because yesterday I was singing one of these songs and I was like, oh my God, how have I not brought this? I want to talk about Schoolhouse Rock.
Oh.
Schoolhouse Rock. It strikes me, I was going to talk about this like later in the segment. I want to say like around 2000 or so, I was definitely like early teens, late tweens. I was in a production called Schoolhouse Rock Live, which was written in 1993. And it was essentially like a stage performance of something like 20 Schoolhouse Rock songs. And because of that, I am intimately familiar with those 20 Schoolhouse Rock songs. It's the nature of like being in a show. You know, have to memorize your lines, or you have to memorize the lyrics of the songs that you sing. And it just so happens that the lyrics of these songs are so like deeply educational about these like incredibly foundational subjects that like I know them very well. However, most of the 64 episode run of Schoolhouse Rock took place in the late 70s right. to early 80s. And so I imagine there's lots of people who were not in the production Schoolhouse Rock Live who maybe have no exposure to Schoolhouse Rock. And that's why I thought it would be like good to talk about it.
There was a lot of like nostalgia in the 90s for like that time period.
Yes.
And so I remember that being like a real cool thing. In the like mid to late 90s of like, hey, look at this super retro looking.
There have been
stuff.
A couple of revivals of Schoolhouse Rock. I think in the 90s there were 8 seasons, right? And the main canon of Schoolhouse Rock exists in the first 4 seasons, which I'll dive into. The 5th season was like Computer Chip Billy inside them. And it was like, I think that was the season that was in the 90s. And it was like all about how computers work. But it was like a month later, like those episodes were outdated. Where it was like, I've got 8 kilobytes of RAM. It's like, no, get the fuck out of here. No way, man. Schoolhouse Rock, if you are like not familiar with it at all, was a series of 3-minute long educational cartoon music videos, essentially tackling a very broad range of subjects that aired on ABC, mostly in the 70s. And like I said, there have been a couple sort of short-lived reboots here and there. I think in the late aughts, there was a short season about climate change. Which is awesome. But the main body, the like songs that everyone talks about when they talk about Schoolhouse Rock, are the first 4 seasons, which cover science, economics, history, mathematics, and civics. which is like a lot of stuff. There's a lot of words in there that bored me, a 33-year-old man, that like enraptured the youths at the time. And they had these songs had so much staying power because of like how catchy they were. The whole series was created by a guy named David McCall, who was an advertising exec. And the story goes that his son was having a lot of trouble with his multiplications tables. But McCall realized that his son also knew all the lyrics to every Rolling Stones song.
Yeah.
So like he sort of put two and two together. He hired a guy named Bob Doro to write a song about multiplication. And that song was called Three is a Magic Number, which is the first episode of Schoolhouse Rock is Three is a Magic Number. And I'm going to play it right now.
A man and a woman had a little baby. Yes, they did. They had three in the family. That's a magic number. 3, 6, 9, 12, 15, 18, 21, 24, 27, 30.
So an animator working at the same firm as David McCall made these visuals to accompany the song, and then they pitched it to ABC as a series where it attracted the attention of Michael Eisner, and then it took off like a rocket.
I feel like my friend had a like alternative rock version where a bunch of musicians got together and did covers of these songs.
Almost certainly, yes, yes. I think that I remember that as well, but I don't, God, it's so hard. There were so many alternative rock covers of every imaginable type of music under the sun. So the first four seasons, I will go in order. The first season, it's multiplication rock. Just what it says on the tin, three is a magic number in there. Also, My Hero Zero, another memorable song, and Figure Eight. Both of those songs were in the musical.
I don't remember these. I just remember three.
Figure Eight is double four. You know that one? Okay, anyway. the next season was Grammar Rock, which is probably pound for pound the one that people know the most songs from. Can you name any songs from Grammar Rock? I'll be curious to see how much this has been. Really?
No.
Conjunction Junction?
Oh,
what's your
conjunction
function?
Conjunction
Junction. We got Unpack Your Adjectives. We got Lolly Lolly Lolly. Get Your Adverbs Here.
Oh my gosh. Yes.
Rufus Xavier Sarsaparilla, a song about pronouns, which was my number that I had to sing,
was
this just endless screed of madness it was the hardest song in the show, and I had to do it because it's all about how it's like Rufus Xavier Sarsaparilla had an armadillo named something something something, and he knew a woman named something 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 something. But you can say that much much faster with pronouns is the whole hook of the song. Anyway, just a lot of bops in Grammar Rock. During the bicentennial in 1976, we get America Rock, which
there
is where you
is.
Get all of your history and
this,
your civics.
This is the one. When I think of Schoolhouse Rock, I think of I'm Just a Bill.
I'm Just a Bill. You get Mother Necessity and The Preamble, which was in the Schoolhouse Rock live musical and saved me in so many different like history classes at that point, because the preamble is literally just the preamble to the Constitution.
Oh, that's handy.
We the people, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty for ourselves and our posterity, to ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. This was 20 fucking years ago. This was 20 years ago. I was in the show, and I remember it.
We had to memorize that in ninth grade, and we did not get that song at our fingertips, and that would have been very helpful.
It's literally, that is all the song. They repeat it from there. It is just the preamble to the Constitution, and I remember it because it took place in song form, and that's incredible.
Yes.
And then the fourth season, the final sort of season of the main run of the show, was Science Rock, which has a few jams in it that are lesser known. Interplanet Janet, which teaches you the planets of the solar system. Do the Circulation, which is all about the circulatory system. We get Victim of Gravity, which is about gravity. But then there's also Electricity, which is also a fantastic song. And the songs, as evidenced by the fact that I can remember one 20 years later, word for word, the songs were super catchy. The show was super well received. And like the amount of sheer educational work done by this program is literally immeasurable. And that is such a tricky needle to thread. Like, educational kids TV programming that is not just sort of vacuous and in sort of like the lessons of which are not sticky, like they're intangible. Like, that is such a difficult thing to pull off.
It is, yeah.
And Schoolhouse Rock, so many of its 64 episodes, of its 64 songs, are incredibly memorable, catchy, well-written, well-performed, and very helpful, mnemonically speaking, songs.
Better than Baby Shark.
Way better than Baby Shark. And I just love them. I love the songs for their educational purposes. I also really loved being in that show because it was like all my friends and I just like, there was not a lot of emotional weight.
Was there choreography?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Dude, the circulation was out of control. You had to get that blood pumping. Yeah. And that's it. I want to end with the final song from Schoolhouse Rock, which is one of my favorite songs. I don't know if you've heard it before. It's The Tale of Mr. Morton, and it's all about subjects and predicates, and I think it's just a really nice, pretty song. So I'll end my segment on that.
Mr. Morton walked down the street. Mr. Morton walked. Mr. Morton talked to his cat. Mr. Morton talked. Hello, cat. You look good. Mr. Morton was lonely. Mr. Morton was. Mr. Morton is the subject of the sentence, and what the predicate says he does.
Do you want to know what our friends at home are talking about?
Yes.
Well, Meredith says, I've gotten into embroidery recently to pass the time. There's something about the action of sewing that is really calming and fun to do. It's also a great way to keep my hands busy while listening to podcasts. Yeah, I've never... My
grandma was like... incredible.
Oh yeah.
At embroidery in her early days, probably close to my age actually.
Yeah.
And I love it. I there's something so it feels like an heirloom. It feels like you're making an heirloom.
Yes,
like
absolutely.
When I see it, I feel like this is something that somebody is going to keep forever.
Like the creepy boy holding a cat that
No, holding a little ball and cup.
Is that what it is?
That's what it is.
Okay. I thought it was a cat.
There is a cat in the picture.
Okay. We have a large embroidery thing that Rachel's grandma made.
Griffin
and it's beautiful.
Certain,
it's well done.
It's
incredibly haunted.
It is certain that it contains the soul of a young child.
Yes. Or that the soul of a young child somewhere contains the painting.
Yeah, it's hard to say.
It's something. There's something. I think we can all agree there's something. Sandra says, a big problem in Minneapolis, especially at the lake by my house, is people feeding ducks human food. To solve this, the city of Minneapolis made little rubber duck picnic table centerpieces, reminding people to not feed the ducks. It's very cute to see little rubber ducks all around the picnic area, and it seems to be very effective.
That's so charming.
It's very nice. I remember I learned... shamefully recently, not shamefully recently, maybe within the last decade or so, because I said something on the like a podcast, like, yeah, man, give a whole baguette to a duck. It'll be awesome. The ducks have earned this. Mm-hmm. And then got a bunch of people who knew much better than me saying, no.
You needed a Schoolhouse Rock song.
I did.
It's like, don't give bread to a duck.
That's
don't
really good.
Give milk to a cat.
Well, are you not supposed to give milk to a cat?
No.
Okay, see, I apparently need this song very importantly. Chocolate is not for dogs. It's important to remember that. Baby.
We're done.
The reboot. It's coming back. Hey, thank you to Bowen and Augustus for the use of our theme song, Money Won't Pay. You can find a link to that in the episode description. And thank you so much to Maximum Fun for having us on the network.
Yeah, you may have seen that they have announced the upcoming Max Fun Drive. You can find a lot more information about that online.
We had promos for it in this exact episode that you're hearing now for more details. But it's kicking off very, very soon. And it's going to be much more low-key than it has been in previous years. And we got some fun stuff.
Yeah, just to like a celebration of the great network that we are on and the great creators that are included in it.
Yes. And I mean, I think that's it. Hey, my new graphic novel that I made with my family comes out next week. We got in a huge box with like 60 copies of it here at our house. So
it's a big old book.
It's a big book. Big, big book.
A lot of work went into that.
Yeah, mostly by Carrie Peach, the illustrator of the book. But you can find it at the Adventure Zone Comic.com. Please pre-order it. That would be very cool of you. I think that's it. I think that's where we're going to wrap it up. Mm-hmm. And,
thank you to Flowers and Trees.
Thanks to Flowers and Trees.
Thanks to Grass and Bushes.
Oh, doing great work this week, Bushes.
Mm-hmm.
Clouds, though.
Clouds.
What is this show turning into?
Clouds and sun.
Clouds, sun, stars, space,
mm-hmm.
air.
Mm-hmm.
All part of the beautiful atomic collage. Oh, God. Is it too late to change the name of the podcast?
No, definitely not.
I'll send an email to Apple.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.
Rocket Ship One, this is Mission Control. Come in.
This is Rocket Ship One. Go ahead.
Rocket Ship, what's your status on Max Fun Drive? Shouldn't we have seen it by now?
Sorry about that, Mission Control. Turns out I miscalculated. Current projected ETA for Max Fun Drive is July 13, but it looks different. It'll be for 4 weeks, so it's longer than expected, but all readings point to low-key?
Oh, that'll be good. But can you verify that there are still special gifts for new and upgrading monthly members?
Verified. Sweet gifts for new and upgrading members, plus amazing new episodes and even special weekly live streams for charity.
Copy that. Rocket Ship, can you confirm ETA for Max Fun Drive?
90% probability of Max Fun Drive from July 13 to August 7.
Did you say 90%?
There were a couple of decimal places, and I might have carried a zero wrong.
I'm just going to pencil in July 13 to August 7. Mission Control out.